Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion. This is the Voice of Kansas, the Abolitionist Hour on Blog Talk Radio, Radio Free Kansas. I'm your host, Carl G. Over 2 million people are in an open-air prison in Palestine. To be prison abolition is to support Palestine. These elite factions that support war, we know their names. We have their names. We've changed our regular scheduling program. It appears World War III has begun. The interwar years are now over. This episode for October 21st, 2023, begins with Vermont Movement News, a panel discussion by the YIVO Institute on anti-Semitism among the left. Then we go back to World War I, where we witnessed the collapse of four empires, the British, the Austro-Hungarian, the Prussian, and how the Ottoman Empire was divided up between France, England, Russia, and Italy. Then we'll take a look at the 1975-76 Civil War in Beirut, Lebanon. This is the Voice of Kansas, the Abolitionist Hour on Blog Talk Radio, Radio Free Kansas. I'm your host, Carl G.
Okay, thank you. The questions have gone on a little bit longer than I hoped, so let me ask the big one of the longer questions. What strategies have worked best in your experience to educate and mitigate against left-wing anti-Semitism? How could the left more constructively approach this issue? And or is there or should there be a distinctly leftist approach to left-wing anti-Semitism? I'll let you all pick whichever corner of that you want to and address it.
Because I'm a fairly miserable person, I'm much better at dealing with what doesn't work than what works. I'll tell you what doesn't work. During the Corbyn years, when the party was, when the anti-Semitism controversy was running out of control, Jeremy Corbyn would make videos at Passover with a Passover message to Jews. And that would involve him, one of them involved a Jewish young person on the left sharing her family's Haggadah and talking about the social justice message of Pesach, which is something that Jeremy Corbyn is clearly warming to. Now, it's ironic given that I have a lot of time for that particular tradition, but this was a disastrous move. It was a disastrous move because Jeremy Corbyn had absolutely no need to work on his relationship with that particular section of the Jewish left. What it came across instead was a validation of a particular kind of Jew. Rather, and there were other examples of this as well. Now, even when he was validating my own kind of Judaism, I would put my head in my hands when I saw this sort of thing because it was absolutely disastrous. And the reason it's disastrous is because it was easy. It's easy Jews to try and bring in people and tell them about our traditions, particularly our progressive traditions, and try and develop a relationship that way. But it's not there that the problem lies. The more successful efforts, or at least the ideal that I would suggest, is something that is massively cynical. A cynical approach in which people try, for tactical reasons, to try and create a serviceable working relationship. And there were people on the left of the Labour Party and in the Corbyn Project who did do that, who were not enveloped in this controversy to the extent that other people were. And this is what I mean by restraining love. It is Corbyn's love that was his major problem. And it is love that is often the problem in progressive circles. Not everywhere, but in some of those areas. So what I've been suggesting throughout my talk is suggesting a much more brittle, difficult, cynical politics that draws coalitions together for strategic reasons without any illusions about how the other is. The same picket line or demonstration on Monday in order to create the conditions in which they could oppose each other at opposing demonstrations on Tuesday. This is what I think is the real answer to this question, and it's not very palatable, and it's not very nice. And I don't seem to get a lot of traction when I suggest it, but I have seen it actually working. I have seen it actually working. And notably, people on the left who have fallen into sort of clearly anti-Semitic thinking, the ones who pull back from that and who learn from that and who don't repeat it are usually the ones who don't have pre-existing relationships with the Jewish left, right? When they do have pre-existing relations with the Jewish left, they can take refuge in that and not really do the accounting. My final thing to say is that I'm not a Christian. I don't really care about the quality of people's souls. I care about behavior. I care about discourse. It doesn't matter to me what people think of Jews. It doesn't matter to me or any other kind of Jew. What matters to me is how we work together, teeth-gritted, sullen solidarity kind of way, to make a world that is better for all of us.
This is the Abolitionist Hour, the voice of Kansas.
The Zionists saw themselves as coming home to the ancestral land of the Jewish people. And that is the drive and the passion behind Israel. The Arabs had been in occupation of this same land since the Middle Ages, and they saw no reason why their land should go from them. So that the difficulty in accommodating to the existence of the State of Israel is inherent. We're dealing with something that is of its nature, has deep roots, and is rather intractable.
Prior to the 20th century, most people in the Middle East defined themselves, one, by their clan. I'm a member of this or that extended family. Two, by the place they are living in, village or city. And three, in terms of religion, mostly, of course, Muslim. So the kind of separate identities within the Arab family is a product of the post-World War I world.
When one considers the economic impact of Jewish settlement in Palestine, one notes that while the land had people on it, those people were concentrated for about 700 years in the hilly areas. This was a part of the Muslim strategy against the Crusaders, keep the shores clear. And thus, conveniently for the Zionists, they could establish themselves in those shore areas where there were very little by way of local inhabitants, hence the dispossession of local inhabitants was very limited. About 2,000 families of peasants dispossessed with compensation. The development of the new areas along the shore by the Jews attracted manpower, especially from the East Bank of Jordan, but also from Syria and Lebanon.
So ironically, to some extent, a good many of the Palestinians who are now in conflict with Israel in the West Bank are as newcomers to this land as most of the Zionists are.
People unfamiliar with the Middle East think that Israel is the only novelty on the political map. And this is, of course, a grave error. Most Middle Eastern states are very new, and almost all of them are born on the debris of the Ottoman Empire in World War I. Biblical land on both banks of Jordan was given to Britain as a special mandate of the League of Nations in 1920. 2 years after the establishment of mandate, Britain has a problem. It had a protege kingdom in the Arabian Peninsula, ruled by a family, a local family, called the Hashemites, led by a man called Hussein. They were to be the kind of British power bases in the Arabian Peninsula. They lose the war against the Saud family, the ancestors of the present rulers of the Saudi Arabian Kingdom, and they flee. They need a job. They need a new power base. Winston Churchill, who was then Minister of Colonies, decides to divide the mandatory kingdom along Jordan River and give the East Bank to this family. For some Machiavellic British calculations, it's only in 1946 that it is made into a separate kingdom under King Abdullah, later his grandson, the present King Hussein.
Within the Arab world, there have always been Arabs who wish to be recognitionist. Beginning in 1913, when Palestine was still part of Turkey, there were Arab nationalists who wanted to make a deal with Jewish nationalists. The tragedy for the Arab camp, the tragedy for Israel, has been that any time there were strong recognitionists who were prepared to negotiate with Israel, they were coerced, intimidated, usually assassinated. Within the family of the leading rejectionist of the modern time, Haji Amin al-Husseini, there was one relative, Fawzi Darwish al-Husseini, who was prepared to talk on the possibilities of a compromise with Israel. He was assassinated in 1946 or 47. The leader of the Arab trade union movement was assassinated in the late 1940s. Indeed, King Abdullah of Jordan, Hussein's grandfather, was assassinated apparently because he wished to make peace.
Tel Aviv, the 14th of May, 1948. The day that Zionist leader David Ben-Gurion declared the establishment of the State of Israel. On the day after the declaration, five Arab armies entered Palestine. The Lebanese attacked from the north, the Syrians, Iraqis, and Jordanians from the east. But the most serious threat came from the south.
The Egyptian army advanced to the village of Yibna, which is 22 kilometers from Tel Aviv. We were a very thin line of soldiers who were defending what was practically the last line of defense of Tel Aviv.
But the pressure on the Israelis was relieved when a UN brokered truce came into effect.
The Zionist movement purchased arms on the European black markets. The Arab armies, of course, enjoyed mainstream supplies from states. The French supplied the Lebanese and the Syrians. The British supplied the Egyptians, the Jordanians, and the Iraqis with a constant stream of arms. In 1948, the United Nations imposed an embargo on arms shipments to the Middle East, and the British and the French abided by this embargo.
When the truce ran out, the Israelis, now better armed, set out to expel the Arab armies from Palestine. By the end of October, as Israeli troops advanced, an Egyptian brigade was encircled at a Palestinian village called Al-Fallujah. Among the officers trapped in this pocket was a young major, Gamal Abdel Nasser. With their armies locked in a stalemate, Egyptian and Israeli delegations met on the island of Rhodes under the sponsorship of the UN. After a month of bargaining, they reached an armistice agreement. The Jewish state now extended over almost the whole of Palestine. Arab territory was reduced to just a few small enclaves. Eastern Jerusalem and the West Bank were placed under Jordanian control. The Gaza Strip was to be administered by Egypt. In the midst of defeat, Gamal Abdel Nasser conceived a plan that would change the future of Egypt, a movement that would be known as the Free Officers. 3 years after the end of the war, the Free Officers struck. In July 1952, they launched a coup d'etat. Egypt's King Farouk was dethroned and sent into exile. Lieutenant Colonel Gamal Abdel Nasser, the mastermind behind what was now called the July Revolution, quickly rose to be the country's de facto leader. In Israel, this news aroused deep-rooted fears in Kibbutz Deir Boker, retirement home of Israel's founding Prime Minister, David Ben-Gurion.
Ben-Gurion all the time feared that one day a new Kemal Ataturk would rise in the Arab world and will unite the entire Arab world against Israel. And that fear, that apprehension, was enhanced when Nasser took power in 1954.
In February 1955, Ben-Gurion returned to political life, this time as defense minister. Just a week after Ben-Gurion took up the post, 150 Israeli paratroopers, led by Major Ariel Sharon, were sent to attack an Egyptian army base near the city of Gaza. 40 Egyptian soldiers were killed and many more injured. Claiming they were Egyptian territorial waters, Nasser closed the Tehran Strait at the entrance to the Gulf of Aqaba to ships sailing to and from the Israeli port of Eilat. To strengthen his army, Nasser sought more weapons from the West, but this time to no avail. So in a surprise move, he turned east.
Egypt signed this huge arms deal with Czechoslovakia.
In November 1955, Ben-Gurion began a second term as Israel's prime minister. At the top of his agenda was how to respond to the growing strength of Egypt, now armed to the teeth. 8 months later, the opportunity came. when Nasser announced the nationalization of the Suez Canal, a decision that outraged the British and French, the owners of the International Canal Company.
This is a matter of life and death to us all. Our quarrel is not with Egypt, still less with the Arab world. It is with Colonel Nasser. He has shown that he's not a man who can be trusted to keep an agreement.
Britain and France were convinced that military intervention would be needed to recapture the canal and bring down the upstart Nasser. But a pretext was needed. According to this tripartite secret agreement, on the 29th of October, 1956, Israeli forces crossed the border into Egypt. Even though the Israelis were still some distance from the canal, Britain and France called for both sides to withdraw. When Nasser rejected the ultimatum, British and French troops began landing in Port Said at the Mediterranean end of the canal.
It is our hope and intent this matter will be brought before the United Nations General Assembly. There, with no veto operating, the opinion of the world can be brought to bear in our quest for a just end to this tormenting problem.
By the end of December, under heavy international pressure, the British and French were forced into a humiliating withdrawal from Port Said. Global attention now shifted to Israel, still occupying the whole of the Sinai and the Gaza Strip. In March 1957, Ben-Gurion finally ordered the Israeli army to withdraw to the pre-war borders.
water, blood. A Babylon, you feel ease up, you just a push and a squeeze up, ease up. Cut away your evil spear. Jah will pour some water in the well. Why you so greedy, greedy? You're up before and needy, needy. You and your fancy talking, yeah. You cool and deadly walking. Your firm and them stalking. Brutalizing and choking.
Stationing of UN troops along the borders with Egypt and Gaza put an end to the Palestinian Fedayeen's raids inside Israeli territories. And Israel was guaranteed free passage of her shipping through the Tiran Strait.
Gave Israel actually about 10 years of unsigned peace on the Egyptian border between 1957 and 1967. There was a total calm.
But the fragile peace on the borders masked continuing hostility between Cairo and Tel Aviv. In Israel, Ezer Weizmann, the commander of the Air Force, was devising a new strategy. Operation Focus. This network would soon face its first major test. Not, though, at the hands of Weizmann's Air Force, but through the bizarre actions of an Israeli peace activist.
Ibn Atan was a commercial pilot. And as a gimmick for the elections of 1965, he bought a little airplane, painted it white and put the name Peace, and said, if I'm elected to the Knesset, I will fly to Egypt. He was not elected. So one day, without any announcement, he took off with this plane.
A.B. Natan landed in Port Said, Egypt, in February 1966.
Egyptians treated him very nicely. They did not let him into Egypt, but they let him fill his tank with gasoline and sent him back.
Natan's flight had revealed the weakness of Egypt's air defenses, but Israel still had a major concern. The MiG-20...
Apartheid in South Africa. The bitter struggle between Arab and Jew for control of the Holy Land has caused untold suffering in the Middle East for generations. It is often claimed that the crisis originated with Jewish emigration to Palestine and the foundation of the State of Israel. Yet the roots of the conflict are to be found much earlier, in British double dealing during the First World War. This is a story of intrigue among rival empires, of misguided strategies, and of how conflicting promises to Arab and Jew created a legacy of bloodshed which has determined the fate of the Middle East. The story of Britain's involvement in the Middle East and the ensuing struggle between Arab and Jew begins with her colonial past. At the beginning of the 20th century, King Edward VII ruled over a vast empire with interests in every part of the world. With this aim in mind, Britain had become the only European power to establish a major foothold in the Middle East, in the principalities around the Persian Gulf, in Aden, and in Egypt. Britain had annexed Egypt from Turkey's Ottoman Empire in 1882, and by the time it was made a protectorate in 1914, Cairo had become the center of British power in the Middle East. The presence of imperial troops in the region was of vital strategic importance, for the Ottoman Empire under Sultan Mohammed V was in alliance with Britain's much-feared rival, Germany. Together with the Austro-Hungarian Empire, these countries made up the Central Powers, and pitted against them were the three allies, Britain, France, and Russia. From the Ottoman capital, Constantinople in Turkey, the Sultan ruled over the last of the great Islamic empires. It had been in almost terminal decline for decades. Yet the fate of the Ottoman Empire was to be sealed by the outbreak of the First World War in August 1914. In Europe, Germany's rapid advance was halted by Britain and France along the Eastern Front. In the East, Russia's war against Germany and Austria-Hungary also reached deadlock. The powerful weapons of the industrial age were killing thousands of men in the trenches of every army. Britain's Prime Minister Asquith felt that with the stalemate in Europe, it was essential to widen the conflict. Together with Foreign Secretary Lord Grey, Minister for War Lord Kitchener, and the First Lord of the Admiralty Winston Churchill, they masterminded a complex strategy to undermine the Central Powers. Britain's secret plan involved on the one hand a military diversion and on the other a devious use of diplomacy through bribery, subversion and double dealing. All these devices focused on the enemy's weakest link, Turkey's Ottoman Empire. The British government hoped that by striking a deal over the spoils of war, it would strengthen the alliance against the Central Powers. Amongst the Allies, Russia had long sought access to the Mediterranean. In a secret treaty of March 1915, Britain and France offered what was to the Tsar a prize of vital geopolitical importance, Constantinople. Italy's King Vittorio Emmanuel was another target for bribery. Britain, France and Russia tried to tempt Italy, a pro-German state, to join the Allies. In April 1915, a secret treaty offered Italy a substantial bit of Ottoman real estate in Anatolia. The bribe worked. Italy joined the Allies and declared war on the Central Powers in August 1915. But Britain's strategy to undermine the enemy via the Ottoman Empire also required subversion. By using domestic opposition to weaken, maybe even destroy it, Britain exploited a new movement sweeping through the empire. Nationalism. This came to a head when the Young Turks took power in a coup in 1908 and started to impose their language and culture on the Arabs of the empire. But this only reawakened an interest amongst Arabs in their own heritage.
Government tried their best to send out the police when they died. They should know. Afraid of anyone in this time.
No, no.
The youth them kick up and now the system start falling.
Oh.
Dirty Babylon and murder them without warning.
Ooh.
been waiting for the signal to strike down, strike down. May Jah protect the innocent people in my town. The ghetto youths are suffering, but we know that we are worth something. So I gonna put my faith in Jah, or I gonna bring your hate in Jah. I know if a revolution starts the same, Babylon will have no heart against the ghetto youth who've tried enough. Defend for a cause, plus we've cried enough. The youth them kick up and now the system start falling. Dirty Babylon, I murder them without warning. Oh, grouping, waiting for the signal to strike down. Make Jah protect the innocent people in my town. The prime example must be set. Creators of war should be put to death. Watch how the soldiers have followed them word. Woe unto the shepherd that mislead the herd. Them try manipulate the people, them mind. Free yourself, my people, now it's about time. And no matter what they put on TV, to create more trouble than them damn policy. They say, them like we put the youth them in a jail. Out of Babylon, the laborers we set sail. May I remind you about Rastafari? We conquer the whole of them there with a blink of an eye. The youth them kick up and now the system start falling. Got dirty Babylon and murder them without warning. Grouping, waiting for the signal to strike down. Make Jah protect the innocent people in my town. Babylon, the whole of them are cursed. Watch them, them are deal with them earth. Oh. The youth them kick up and now the system start falling. Dirty Babylon, I murder them without warning. Oh, grouping, waiting for the signal to strike down.
A 1,000 years before, Arabs had brought the technology and literature of the East to the West, and their religion, Islam, had encompassed much of Asia, North Africa, and southwestern Europe. The idea of recovering that historic grandeur had remained in the consciousness of Arab intellectuals. By the start of the First World War, the antagonism between Arab and Turk had increased. By the summer of 1915, British intelligence confirmed that the Arab nationalist movement was the breakthrough the government was looking for. Britain and her French ally dispatched officers to sound out Arab leaders. The idea was to tempt the Arabs into a revolt against their Ottoman overlords and create a diversion which would tie down the central powers in the Middle East. Ironically, the impetus for such a diversion had come not from London, but from the Arab world. In the Hejaz, in Western Arabia, Sheriff Hussein, its ruler, was set on extending his political and geographical domain. He believed he might be able to do it with the help of the British. In turn, the British were impressed by Sheriff Hussein's family credentials as custodians of the holy places of Islam. A chance, too, for the British, who saw support for Sheriff Hussein as a way to threaten the Sultan's hold on the Caliphate, the political leadership of the Islamic world. In July 1915, Sheriff Hussein smuggled a message to the British High Commissioner in Cairo, Sir Henry McMahon, offering to raise a substantial Arab force against the Ottomans in return for British support for Arab independence. In the ensuing secret correspondence between the two men, Sheriff Hussein was given to understand that he could expect British support in achieving some of his ambitions in the event of an Ottoman defeat, This letter of October the 26th, 1915, outlined the main points of the arrangement. Taking Britain's assurances of support at face value, Hussein, together with his sons Faisal and Abdullah, amassed a sizable force. The new army was commanded by the young and charismatic Faisal, who had captured the imagination of the Arab masses in the quest for Arab independence. Yet even as Hussein and Faisal mobilized their troops, the British were preparing to sell them short. Back in London, in the spring of 1916, Britain was negotiating with France about the future shape of the Middle East. Behind closed doors, Sir Mark Sykes of the British Foreign Office had been meeting his French opposite number, François-Georges Picot. Britain knew it was vital to offer the French a stake in the spoils of the Ottoman Empire should they win the war. Poring over a map of the Levant, Sykes and Picot personally drew in the areas they wished to see under their control. Their secret deal amounted to the virtual carve-up of the Middle East. In Area A for the French and Area B for the British, the imperialists intended to exercise power indirectly. They would appoint advisers and take charge of the finances in their respective spheres of influence. Then there was the area coloured blue, which was to be directly controlled by France. This included what was then known as Greater Syria, where the French traditionally had commercial and religious interests. As for the area coloured pink, known as Iraq, with its strategic ports, railways and oil, this was to be under British rule. The area, coloured yellow, represented Palestine and was envisaged as an international zone, except for Haifa.
Just Salallahu.
Unaware of these secret dealings behind their backs, Hussein and Faisal proclaimed independence and in June 1916 attacked the Turkish troops. The Arab revolt against the Ottomans had begun. The Turkish garrison at Mecca was soon overrun and the seaport at Jeddah seized. By 1917, Hussein and Faisal's forces had pushed north and engaged the Ottoman Turks along the Hejaz Railway. The British saw the Arab revolt as part of its strategy for creating a military diversion against the Central Powers. In a pincer movement, Britain had launched a campaign from the southwest to ensure control of the Suez Canal and the Levant. And from the southeast, it was fighting to secure the oil wells of Iraq. All this to attack the Central Powers at their weakest point, the Ottoman Empire. While the Arab army advanced northwards, Britain's General Allenby had crossed the Suez Canal, and by the spring of 1917, his forces had reached the frontier of Palestine. The war in Europe, however, was still not going well for Britain. The attempted push through the German lines at the Somme had produced little territorial gain, and the cost in lives was colossal. In London, there had been a change of leadership. The new Prime Minister, Lloyd George, felt that the Allied war effort needed a fresh impetus. Although America had so far been neutral in the war, Lloyd George was convinced that could be changed. He believed there was one powerful group which might influence the American government. Many Jews in the upper echelons of German society did indeed have close connections to the Kaiser's Foreign Office. A new Jewish nationalist movement, Zionism, had also been able to establish its headquarters in Berlin. Zionism had originated in the 1880s after Theodor Herzl published a book espousing the virtues of a Jewish state. This caused a sensation amongst Jewish intellectuals in Germany, Austria, and Russia, who shared Herzl's outrage at the escalation of anti-Jewish sentiments. What had also given Zionism its appeal was the way in which it fitted in to historic Jewish aspirations. Scattered throughout the world since the destruction of the Jerusalem Temple in the first century AD, many Jews had cherished the idea of returning one day to what their scriptures had told them was the Promised Land. In fact, there had already been a small community of indigenous Jews in Palestine. But even when some European Jews established settlements throughout the late 19th century, the whole Jewish community by 1914 constituted barely 8% of the population. The Zionist leader in Britain, Chaim Weizmann, had been lobbying the government for a guarantee that in the event of an Ottoman defeat, it would support Jewish emigration to Palestine. By early 1917, Lloyd George's view of Jews as globally influential convinced him that Zionism was another nationalist movement which should be co-opted to the Allied cause. In March, Mark Sykes began negotiations with Weizmann.
There is a bee in the bonnet of people like Mark Sykes.
As negotiations with Weizmann continued over the following months, the war deteriorated rapidly for the Allies. The German submarine campaign was seriously weakening Britain's merchant fleet. And although America had entered the war on the Allied side, President Woodrow Wilson was not yet willing to supply a significant number of troops. Britain's latest attempt to keep up the pressure on the Western Front soon became bogged down in the muddy trenches of Passchendaele. As thousands of young men's lives were wasted in another fruitless campaign, morale amongst the soldiers plummeted.
Capital punishment! Capital punishment! If I had the key to keep the GDP, I would have set all prisoners free. If I had the key to keep the GDP, I would have set the prisoners free. Cause the crimes of the shepherds who have heard, they have never been tested, none have never been arrested. And the crime go on, the wicked get strong. Yes, if I had the key to keep the GDP, I would have set all prisoners free. If I had the key to keep the GDP, I would have set the prisoners free. Where you get the gun that shoot your brother tongue, or even the knife that take your neighbor life? The frustration you feel that cause you to steal, if I build a fence round a coconut tree, that would cause you to steal from me. Yes, if I had the key to GDP, I would have set the prisoners free. Thought that you're entertained in your head, about who I know you would have liked it dead. Cause them not accept your youth with them dread. You lay down every night, can't sleep in your bed. Yes, if I had the key to GDP, I would have set all prisoners free. If I had the key to GDP, I would have set the prisoners free. Big belly man, sit and criticize. Talk about how the youth them no wise. And every day is just lies, lies, lies. Them shoot another youth for stealing a boot. In future look.
Kiss the pop, kiss the pop. toys to play with. Nanny and Danny. Lots of friends to stay with.
The most serious threat to the Allied war machine came from the east. Russia was on the verge of collapse. After massive defeats at the hands of the Germans, the war-weary country was disintegrating, with food shortages, strikes, and demonstrations. When the Tsar was deposed in a revolution, Britain and France became greatly alarmed. In October, the British government received an intelligence report suggesting that Jews were a significant influence in the leadership of the Bolshevik Party, the new revolutionary movement emerging as the dominant force in Russia. Lloyd George feared that these communists would take Russia out of the war. With the Americans still refusing to commit sufficient forces, he knew it was time to act. He instructed his foreign secretary, Arthur Balfour, to issue a pledge to capture the hearts and minds of the Jewish people. The Balfour Declaration was issued on November the 2nd, 1917, just as British forces were occupying Palestine. But this was also the first time that any major European power had given official backing for the Zionist goal of making Palestine into a Jewish homeland. Yet Sharif Hussein had understood that Palestine had been promised as part of his deal for Arab independence. Anticipating Arab outrage at the prospect of a Jewish homeland in a largely Arab province, the Balfour Declaration had also stated that
nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine.
The declaration, nonetheless, appeared to indicate British support for Jewish emigration. In fact, the only treaty Britain had signed in regard to Palestine was with the French, the secret Sykes-Picot Agreement. On November the 7th, within a few days of the Balfour Declaration, the Bolsheviks took power in Russia. Lloyd George hoped that it would have the desired effect of appeasing the Jews in the communist leadership.
Yeah.
The wildly inaccurate intelligence report on which Lloyd George based his strategy was to have major implications for Britain. Within weeks, Russia's new leaders did exactly the opposite of what he had expected. Not only did they pull out of the war, they opened up the archives of the Tsarist Foreign Office and published the secret treaties. The very treaties Britain had engineered with her allies to carve up the Ottoman Empire and to which Russia had been privy. Amid Arab confusion and suspicion, General Allenby entered Jerusalem on foot, together with Sykes, Pico, and a number of other Allied notables. His British-led forces had captured the Holy City in December 1917. The leaders of the Arab revolt, however, were nowhere to be seen. Fearing that Hussein and Faisal might lose heart, the British government forwarded a message to them, reiterating British commitment to Arab independence.
The Arab race shall be given full opportunity of once again forming a nation in the world. This can only be achieved by the Arabs themselves uniting, and Great Britain and her allies will pursue a policy with this ultimate unity in view.
Hussein stayed loyal to the Allied cause, still prepared to accept Britain's word on Arab independence, although he spoke of settling accounts after the war. From Allenby's point of view, he continued to rely on Arab support in the war against the Ottomans. But now that Jerusalem had been occupied by the British, one party seized the initiative.
Yeah. cotton. My granddaddy cut your sugar cane just because of the system. I've been caught as a victim. From the black, you want to stay a bad. Racial discrimination. The whole racial discrimination. If you're brown, them say you can hang around. But if you're black, they want you to stay back. Racial, can't stand this racial discrimination. No, 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 no. Racial, can't stand this racial discrimination, Lord. Racial.
In April 1918, Chaim Weizmann and the International Zionist Commission traveled to Palestine to lay the foundation for a Hebrew university. Their hope was that it would become the intellectual hub of Zionism. Weizmann's visit, however, caused widespread alarm and indignation among the Arab population. And when he and the chief rabbi of Jerusalem met General Allenby, it looked as if Britain was preparing to honor the Balfour Declaration. Six months later, Allenby's forces entered Damascus. With their ally, Faisal's Northern Army, they had pushed the Ottoman troops north through Palestine into Syria. On the 3rd of October, the people of Damascus flocked to Faisal's victory parade. If he was to seize power, he knew it was of great importance to make his presence felt and to be seen by the Arab people as their liberator. Later the same day, however, Faisal met with General Allenby at the Victoria Hotel in Damascus. Allenby warned him that his rule in Syria would be limited. But Britain and her old ally France were up against the American President Woodrow Wilson's vision of a new world order which promoted national self-determination.
Once independence had seemed to be a possibility, termination, supported by the Americans, was going to be offered to all those who were to be liberated from former empires like the Habsburgs and the Ottomans. What the Palestinians wanted was an independent state.
In fact, Faisal had come from Damascus to plead the Arab cause. But the future of Palestine in the Middle East formed part of Britain's pledge to France in the Sykes-Picot carve-out. In the event, Woodrow Wilson's principles about self-determination were forgotten when it came to the people of the Middle East. Britain and France were free to go ahead with their agreement. But what of the promises Britain had made to the Jews regarding Palestine? Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour, in a confidential memo during the Versailles peace talks with America, France and Italy, wrote,
"The four great powers are committed to Zionism, and Zionism, be it right or wrong, good or bad, is rooted in age-long traditions, in present needs, in future hopes, of far profounder import than the desires and prejudices of the 700,000 Arabs who now inhabit that ancient land."
That might sound like a warm endorsement of Zionism, yet further in the post-war memorandum, Balfour hints at a much more cynical agenda.
"So far as Palestine is concerned, the powers have made no declaration of policy, which at least in letter, they have not always intended to violate."
The Versailles Peace Conference was concluded on June the 28th, 1919, with the creation of the League of Nations, the first global institution for peace and security. Its covenant provided that the Arab and other territories ceded by the defeated Ottoman Empire should be administered by mandates, which meant, in effect, that Britain and France were given the authority to impose their rule over the Arab territories.
Tell me, hey, if this ever happened to you, or any of your foundation, listen to God, the racism, the killing, hey, the lynching, hey, raping, the price you want steal you, like animals, them parade you, take it and shame you. From a slave ship named Jesus, enforcing religion, destroying we Africans in a strange land. Abomination, the Ku Klux Klan, them a Satan, them no human. Hey, Bonaneda, 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 fire upon them. Tell me now.
On November the 21st, 1919, François-Georges Picot, the co-architect of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, and the French general Gouraud arrived in Beirut. And so began the imposition of the French mandate for Syria and Lebanon. The British forces, who had occupied the region since ousting the Ottoman Turks during the last months of the war, were handing over power to the French, thus fulfilling their wartime pledge. Faisal, who had been the governor of Damascus now for 16 months, had been consolidating his position. When he was proclaimed king by the Syrian National Congress, the French were incensed, and General Gouraud sent in his troops. By August the 7th, 1920, Faisal had been deposed and had to flee to Palestine. The promises to Sharif Hussein and Faisal of a single independent state were now a distant memory for the Europeans.
The whole issue of spheres of influence meant that what at first appeared to be a willingness to accept a single Arab state was in fact seriously diluted. And then on top of that, of course, the very fact of there being a French area and a British area meant that in effect this was the seed of partition. So you had both independence was denied, but also the unity of this area was denied.
The boundaries and governments of the Middle Eastern states that emerged bore the unmistakable imprint of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. The French half of the previously Ottoman province of Greater Syria became the mandate for Lebanon and Syria. The other half became the British mandate for Transjordan and Palestine. In the east, the Ottoman area of Mesopotamia, which included the oil fields of Mosul, was given to Britain as the mandate for Iraq. But British rule was initially rejected by the Iraqi people until Faisal was installed as king in July 1921. Britain hoped the limited power it devolved to him would serve to placate the frustrated demands for Arab independence. But Sharif Hussein expected more from the British.
He never gave up the idea that the British had promised him independence, not only in Arabia, but in Syria and Iraq as well. and he wanted the British to fulfill their promises.
Sharif Hussein's dream of an Arab kingdom ruled by the Hashemites was only partially fulfilled. For although his other son, Abdullah, became king of Transjordan, their old rival, Ibn Saud, swept the Hashemites out of Hijaz when he conquered the whole of the Arabian Peninsula. In Jerusalem, an administration was established by the British in the spring of 1920. There were no plans for devolving power in Palestine. Palestine was a land sacred to three religions. Jews were a small minority who had lived harmoniously with Christians and the much larger community of Muslims for hundreds of years. But the Balfour Declaration, promising Jews a homeland in Palestine, had been incorporated into the British Mandate at Versailles. Palestine was thus to be open for new European Jewish immigration. With celebrations and parades in support of Zionist activities, it seemed as if the British were going to honor their pledges to the Jews and ignore Palestinian hopes of independence.
The Arabs had a strong case, but very poor advocates. The Zionists had a case. It wasn't as strong as that of the local Arabs, but they had brilliant advocates. Zionism is one of the greatest public relations success stories of the 20th century. And Chaim Weizmann exemplified these traditional Jewish skills of advocacy and persuasion.
Some of these skills were clearly in evidence when Weizmann and various Zionist groups helped finance land purchases and the building of settlements for immigrant Jews. At the same time, political and security organizations were created to support the emerging Jewish homeland. The Arab community in Palestine was incensed. In 1925, Arthur Balfour toured the new Jewish settlements in Palestine. Although he was feted as a hero of the Zionist cause, the immigration of European Jews was to have unforeseen consequences for British rule in Palestine.
I believe that the Balfour Declaration was one of the most serious mistakes in British imperial history. It committed Britain to support of Jewish nationalism in Palestine after the war, and it did not produce any immediate benefits for Britain.
Without the Balfour Declaration, there could have been no genuine development of a Jewish national home, and the follow-through in 1948, where you get the creation of a State of Israel, simply would not have happened. It requires the umbrella of the British to be there, in effect, to support the emerging Jewish national home militarily at the bottom line. The very fact that there are
British troops, British policemen, there to protect the Jewish communities is ultimately central to the situation. It could not have been done in any other way.
Throughout the 1930s and 40s, the years of Nazi persecution and the Holocaust, Jewish immigration to Palestine increased rapidly. But what was seen by the Arabs as an alien incursion and the Jews as a fulfillment of historic rights led to polarization and violence. In response to terrorist acts by Arabs, Britain restricted the immigration. But the policy only stimulated Jewish terrorism. Against this background, Britain relinquished its mandate, and the State of Israel was born in 1948. When the first of several wars between the new state and its Arab neighbors began, thousands of Palestinian Arabs fled their homeland. Thus, the strategies employed by Britain to win the First World War inadvertently left a deep divide between Arab and Jew.
The most serious consequences of British policy during the war was the encouragement of Arab nationalism and Jewish nationalism. And in the aftermath of the First World War, Britain was left with this legacy of double dealing and of betrayal, which was to haunt her for a long, long time.
Clearly, it played a role in dividing the Arab world into different states, in allowing the establishment of the State of Israel, and in frustrating Arab desires. But if what happened in Sykes-Picot and everything else that happened in the First World War is used as an excuse for the problems of the Middle East now, I think that would be a mistake. But yes, the roots of what we see today certainly arose from the double dealing of the First World War and from the frustrated expectations of that time.
Thinking then, the wicked man up here, corruption, corruption. My people have had enough. Them said them want the good stuff, no more corruption, corruption. Maybe you them start ill, and none of the ghetto you them not ill at all. Corruption, corruption. You come and betray, you hear me say, well, at all. Corruption, corruption. When I stop dark it out, hear the words up from me mouth, me not scout. Walk away from the sinking sand, the wicked man. I won't go, I won't go.
Since the Middle Ages, and they saw no reason why their land should go from them.
One of the success stories of our time is the ability of the small Israeli population of 800,000 to absorb this massive wave of refugees and integrate them as citizens of Israel. This stands in sharp contrast to the problems which the Arab nations, with their huge expanse and their great wealth, had integrating the 300,000-400,000 Arab persons who were displaced as a result of the Arab-Israel War in 1948. The reason there was an Arab refugee problem is because countries which previously had been host countries for Arab migration, with its oil resources, which had always received Palestinian Arabs, decided that Arab immigrants who came to these countries as a result of the war were now refugees, were to be segregated into camps, were not to be given citizenship.
The Palestine refugee problem is an absolute anomaly in history.
other refugee problems end either tragically in that the population is completely decimated, or it ends historically, they're displaced, they move elsewhere, or they find some form of a homeland. One of those solutions has appeared for all the other major refugee problems in the world. The Palestinian refugee problem remained the way it is for more than three generations because the Arab countries wished it to be that way. None of them was willing to accept the fact of Israel. So they kept alive a fiction that Israel would be eliminated, and therefore the refugees should sit where they were until the day would come when they would be able to overthrow Israel and retrieve their nation. Now, since 67, at least, it has been clear to all the Arab countries that that was not going to happen. Yet it was a cynical political process that they kept alive, the greatest victims of which were the Palestinians throughout.
The PLO was established in 1964 as the product of two currents. One, new consciousness rising among young refugees, mostly in Gaza, the Gulf states, and Egypt, who looked for some new Palestinian leadership. The other was the need of President Nasser of Egypt to find a new vehicle for defiance against Israel, him being quite conscious that conventional war wouldn't do.
Terrorism has been a common strategy of so-called liberationist movements, both on the right and on the left. It's always difficult to say which of those two directions best describes the PLO. Since World War II, and we have records of debates about the use of terrorism in a variety of organizations of that sort, perhaps most interestingly in the IRA, in the struggle in Northern Ireland. The IRA split over the issue of random attacks on innocent people. And there have been similar debates and similar splits in other liberationist movements. One of the peculiarities of the PLO, in my view, is that we have no record of debates over the use of terror. We have no record of opposition within the movement to the use of terror. We have no record of significant figures, political leaders or intellectuals who have split from the PLO because they oppose the use of terror. So in contrast to other movements, these have been terrorists without a bad conscience. The support that the PLO has had in the Arab world may represent the guilt, because in fact the payments of money and the extraordinary rhetorical extravagance of the support have gone along with very little concrete political and military help. It's clear that the PLO is not, in fact, popular in the Arab world. That wasn't clear before Beirut. It is certainly clear now that the PLO forces have been dispersed to eight Arab states, because everywhere they go, they are greeted in rowdy and effusive demonstrations and then packed off to what are essentially internment camps. The expressions of support do somehow sit alongside of a lack of effective commitment.
Let's focus on one thing.
Wicked, 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 wicked. They are wicked, 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 wicked. They are
biggest criminals. I said they might the rulers of the nation.
Wicked.
Them my freemen who said them not really care about life.
They worship the gun, oil, drugs.
The chemicals and ammunition.
Wicked.
You think you rule the world, but you're gonna get a great big surprise.
Mind you get struck by a pride and couldn't stop me. Them, the microchip, them won't be trapped me. Private science prison blocks, them won't be locked me, yo. Burn up the capitalists, got them full of a scheme of murderers, killers, I said them are leaders.
Vampires.
Them, I said them are the rulers of the nation.
Wicked.
War. Them, I free men, no, so them no really care about life, no. They worship the
gun, oil, drugs.
The chemicals and ammunition. Yeah, mashing up the world, but you're gonna get a great big surprise. When Africans unite worldwide, make the link, they wage the war against the poor. We're living on the brink of destruction. Them done suspend the constitution. All your rights and privileges, them don't get fun of like petroleum.
بالبيت يلي ناصر التلي افتح الباب وبوس الحيطان.
Lebanon was a hapless country, a very weak country, virtually no army to speak of. The Lebanese were unable to resist their coming. They were unwilling to absorb them into the Lebanese population because they feared this would alter the Christian-Muslim balance. And so they left them in camps which grew larger and larger, uncontrolled by anyone but the PLO, which over time emerged as an armed force, a government, and the camps became veritably cities in themselves.
Lebanon, of course, had ceased to be an organized state. It was a political jungle inhabited by about 80 different paramilitary factions, many of them hostile to Israel, and about the strongest of the factions was the PLO, with its very heavy armament right on Israel's border, devoted in principle to the abolition of the state of Israel. No other state, I think, would have tolerated that for very long on its own borders, and there was that reason for intervention. Associated with that is the fact that Israel saw the PLO in Lebanon as casting a shadow over the West Bank, as threatening any Arabs on the West Bank who might consider reaching any kind of accommodation with Israel.
Claims to be the authentic representative of the Palestinian people, and it has been recognized as the authentic representative by other Arab states, by many European states, as you know, and even by the by organs of the United Nations. But I think that that is a false description. The PLO is the authentic representative of the refugees in Lebanon, and above all of the inhabitants of the camps, who are in fact something less than half of the refugees in Lebanon. These people it truly speaks for. Of these people it can be said that the PLO represents their interests. But I think it is very important to stress that a large portion of the Palestinian people are not refugees, are living where they have always lived, on the West Bank and in Gaza, and that those people have interests quite radically different from the interests of the refugees and the political leaders in Beirut. And the difference can be put very simply. The refugees in Lebanon come from Beersheba and Haifa and Jaffa. And when they talk of going home, they mean going home to those places. That's why they can never be satisfied with a mini-state on the West Bank. That is not the name of their dream. It's not the goal of PLO politics.
The Palestinian camps were refugee camps in the traditional sense, the ones that I visited frequently. I come back year after year and watch the growth of them. was really rather astounding. They had schoolrooms, most of which was paid for by UNRWA, where unfortunately you would hear the 5 and 6 year olds singing songs calling for the destruction of Israel and the return to the homeland. So they were not a very healthy place to be. There was a great deal of disease, and more than anything else, melancholy, in the sense of younger men, 17, 18, 19, with absolutely nothing to do, who clearly became the trainees for the PLO operations. Their recruits came out of these camps. I visited numerous times in the three big camps around the Beirut airport and in Tyre and Sidon. And that's when I met Arafat the first time, and long chats with him. When you got a tour through the camp by Arafat, he spoke of these camps as my place, my people, my city, my army. This was how he envisaged these camps as his domain, even though they were parked in another country. They were parked in Lebanon. The PLO clearly manipulated the camps, as we saw in the Lebanese War, because they became the cover and protection for their activities. They intermingled with the civilians living there, which afforded them a certain amount of protection against invasion and against bombing on the fear that a lot of civilian people would be killed. They clearly dominated the people, sometimes by great intimidation. And they became a country within a country, which ultimately led to the civil war in Lebanon in 1976 and on, because they tipped the balance of power finally against the Christian element in the Lebanon.
Certainly, on the scale of violence of the Middle East today, 75-76 ranks very high. 82 can't compete. About 80,000 inhabitants, mostly civilians, were killed in the Lebanese civil war of 75-76. The extent of damage was of the order of magnitude of one half of the Lebanese GNP. Beirut, as the financial and touristic capital of the Middle East, was dead.
It's important to remember that the fighting in Lebanon did not begin with the Israeli attack. It's been endemic in the country for some years, and it had its most extraordinary flare-up in 75-76, when civil war was interrupted by what was in effect the Syrian invasion. The casualties inflicted by various Lebanese factions on one another and by the Syrians on a variety of Lebanese factions, fighters and civilians alike, were far, far higher than any estimate of the casualties inflicted in the recent fighting. And at the same time, it has to be said that the response of the world, the response perhaps most importantly in Western Europe and the United States, the response of the UN, was quite different. Israel is treated as a member of the moral community of the West. And the Arabs are, it's perhaps one of the most patronizing things the media do to them, the Arabs are treated as if they were not part of that community. And of course they are, or they should be, and they should be held to the same standards.
Fredlock said that.
We hear a great deal about the Israeli invasion of Lebanon as though this were an act of war that began hostilities on June 6, 1982. The fact of the matter is that Israel has been at war with PLO since the inception of the PLO. There's never been a time, from the point of view of the PLO, certainly, that there was not a war. The war has had ebbs and flows. It has been quiescent, it's warmed up. We've had formal campaigns like the Latani campaign. We've had intermediate flare-ups like the 1981 July fighting. And we've had long periods when there would be occasional isolated acts of terrorism and Israeli reprisals. But basically that war has continued right along. Starting in early 1981, the Israelis began to get concerned when their intelligence picked up the fact that incredibly large quantities of military hardware were being shipped into Lebanon for the PLO, mainly coming via Libya. Almost all of it Soviet equipment, heavy equipment. The PLO buildup in June 1982 was simply staggering. They had hundreds of artillery pieces that can fire 17 miles. They had multiple rocket launchers that could fire hundreds of rockets in a few seconds. All of these were mobile. All of these could be wheeled out in the desert, attacked Israeli towns and settlements in northern Israel, and then fade back into the areas of Lebanon that weren't being controlled by anybody, despite the UN presence. It's absolutely clear that the commitment is not only to regain the Palestinian homeland for the PLO, the commitment is to do it by armed force. So the Israelis decided to go in after the enemy that had now built itself up to a size well in excess of 15,000 armed men, living in a state within a state, within a weak country that couldn't control them.
The PLO clearly manipulated the camps, as we saw in the Lebanese War, because they became the cover and protection for their activities. They intermingled with the civilians living there, which afforded them a certain amount of protection against invasion and against bombing on the fear that a lot of civilian people would be killed. They clearly dominated the people, sometimes by great intimidation. And they became a country within a country, which ultimately led to the civil war in Lebanon in 1976 and on, because they tipped the balance of power finally against the Christian element in the Lebanon.
Certainly, on the scale of violence of the Middle East today, 75-76 ranks very high. 82 can't compete. About 80,000 inhabitants, mostly civilians, were killed in the Lebanese civil war of 75-76. The extent of damage was of the order of magnitude of one half of the Lebanese GNP. Beirut, as the financial and touristic capital of the Middle East, was dead.
It's important to remember that the fighting in Lebanon did not begin with the Israeli attack. It's been endemic in the country for some years, and it had its most extraordinary flare-up in 75-76, when civil war was interrupted by what was in effect the Syrian invasion. The casualties inflicted by various Lebanese factions on one another and by the Syrians on a variety of Lebanese factions, fighters and civilians alike, were far, far higher than any estimate of the casualties inflicted in the recent fighting. And at the same time, it has to be said that the response of the world, the response perhaps most importantly in Western Europe and the United States, the response of the UN, was quite different. Israel is treated as a member of the moral community of the West. And the Arabs are, it's perhaps one of the most patronizing things the media do to them, the Arabs are treated as if they were not part of that community. And of course they are, or they should be, and they should be held to the same standards.
People who specialize and like to brutalize people with different color skin and eyes should be hospitalized. They are mentally disturbed. To be racist is an illness, it's like madness, we must cure this. To be racist is an illness, it's like madness, we must cure this. What a shame, oh what a pity, racist activity all over the city. Oh what a shame, oh what a pity, racist mentality all over the city. Rich society of the sickness, to be racist is an illness, it's like madness, we must cure this. To be racist is an illness, it's like madness, they must cure this. To be racist is an illness, it's like madness, we must cure this. To be racist is an illness, it's like madness, we must cure this. Threatening children outside school is out of order, not in the rules. Stamp out racism. No!
No, no, no. Israel is an open society on principle. Lebanon was open involuntarily, having fallen into anarchy. The result was that the cameras could follow the violence in this case, as they could not, for example, when Assad in Syria repressed a rebellion in Hama at the cost of approximately 20,000 to 30,000 lives.
in the fighting in Lebanon, the PLO graduated from individual and small group terrorism to city terrorism. They held a whole city as a hostage, literally, so that it became very difficult for the Israelis to go in after them. But then when the Israelis didn't go in and fight them in a kind of Stalingrad, then they pronounced it a great victory that the cowardly Israelis had not followed them in.
Well, I was in Lebanon in September 1981, and I was there again in July of this year after the Israeli intervention. And I went around and talked with people there, both Shi'i Muslims, which is most of the population, Christians, and Druzes. And very definitely, and from all the people I talked to, the impression was of people who felt themselves to have been under foreign occupation, the occupation of the PLO, who were under shock because of the recent fighting, but who all of them welcomed the enforced departure of the PLO, and all of them said that they hoped Israel would go from Lebanon, but would not go until they had made sure the PLO would not come back.
The significance of the outpouring of anguish and concern in Israel when the reports came out of the Sabra and Shatila massacres is indicative of the kind of concern we would expect in a democratic state with a high regard for fundamental human dignity, which we have in Israel and which we have in the United States. The result of this popular concern turns out to be governmental action, action that is embarrassing and difficult for the government in power. It is impossible to imagine this occurring in any other Middle East country, but the idea that people would come out peaceably and in effect petition their government to look into a question is unique in Israel, in the Middle East, and one might add it's fairly unique in the world. The double standard that the United States applies to Israel as a close friend is very well illustrated in the fact that when Amin Jamal of Lebanon came to this country, he was accorded the greatest respect and friendship. No question was ever raised about the Sabra and Shatila massacres, which after all occurred in his country, carried out by his fellow Christian Lebanese. Yet he was honored in Washington, in the United Nations. No one ever raised this question at all. While it's understandable that one would want to give Jamal a good start and encourage him, still the double standard is very, very dramatically displayed by this asymmetry between the treatment of Jamal and the continuing attitude towards Israel's indirect role in this action by Lebanese against Palestinians.
It is said that higher standards are expected of Israel than of other countries. I think this is a legitimate argument for Israel to apply to itself. It seems to me that for outsiders, it would be healthier for us to judge Israel by approximately the same standard that we apply to our own government. I don't believe, for example, that any Western government opposed to the kind of provocation that Israel got from the PLO through Lebanon would just have sat back and let that go on. I'm very sure indeed that Mrs. Thatcher's government would have done nothing of the kind, although she was very quick to condemn the Israel intervention in southern Lebanon.
The Israelis are held to higher moral standards than the Syrians. Sometimes the Israelis complain about it. I think they are probably wrong to complain. It is a sign of respect. The failure of Western liberals and leftists to wax indignant at the time of the Syrian intervention was an example of old colonialist and racist habits. They don't see in the Arabs moral equals. They do see in the Israelis moral equals. That, as I say, I don't think Israel should complain about that. It is an honor. The Arabs should complain about it.
I think when all of the dust settles, it will be clear that what Israel did was in its own immediate security self-interest needs. It did break the back of the PLO, which is a plus for all of the Western world, including the United States. And I think in the long run, history will probably judge the actions to have been correct. Nevertheless, the problem of Palestinian nationalism remains. That has not been resolved by the Lebanon War. And I think the United States is going to try to press and urge and push Israel in the direction of resolving the Palestinian nationalist question in conjunction with the other players in the area. And that's where the ambit of diplomacy will unfold in the next few years.